Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I'm worried about Michael Phillips. I'm afraid of what he might do if anything should happen to me.
Phillips?
But he's a robot. Without you, what could he do?
There's no limit to what he could do. He could destroy the Earth.
For a robot sent to threaten Earth with annihilation, Michael Phillips has great taste in movies.
It's true. We're always picking on Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune here. I don't know what the deal is. Of course, in this case, he's actually Gort from 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still, a possible candidate for this week's top five things from space that came to destroy us.
That top five, plus Scarlett Johansson as an alien seductress in Under the Skin, and Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston as a vampire couple in Jim Jarmusch's latest Only Lovers Left Alive. All that and more.
Phillips, Klaatu, Arada, Nikhtil.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM414. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We come in peace. This week's top five, not so much. Things from space that came to destroy us. That's later in the show. Neil before Zod, Josh.
I'd Neil before Terrence Stamp, but not you, Adam.
Fair enough.
Before we get to that top five, who would cast Loki and the White Witch as a married vampire couple? Jim Jarmusch, that's who, in Only Lovers Left Alive.
You being so reclusive and everything is probably only going to make people more interested in your music.
Yeah. What a drag.
Hello? What is it? You look tired.
Can't you tell your wife what your problem is?
It's the way they treat the world.
And now they've succeeded in contaminating their own blood, never mind their water.
Typo negativo.
Been expecting you for some reason, Dr. Faust.
I'll come. It's just the traveling that's such a drag.
Our top five this week, things from space that came to destroy us, was inspired by the new movie Under the Skin, because we're pretty literal here on Film Spotting, and Scarlett Johansson's character came from space, and, well, she isn't seducing men because she's seeking spirited conversation and companionship. That we're devoting our main review to Only Lovers Left Alive, the first film from legendary indie director Jim Jarmusch since 2009's The Limits of Control, is random but convenient when you consider that Jarmusch's titular lovers, played by Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton, are centuries-old vampires, and Johansson's alien has some vampiric qualities. Sunlight isn't really a concern, but she does her best stalking at night, and those men I mentioned, let's just say they seem to fulfill a very practical need. Of course, vampires are in their own way aliens. They don't come from other parts of the universe, but they aren't exactly human either. And both vampire movies and alien movies often explore the uneasy relationship between humans and these others, with the monsters meant to represent something larger. Google vampires as metaphors, and the results turn up theories from the very specific, and I quote here, the 19th century Englishman's hatred of and contempt for Eastern Europeans, to the more abstract, vampires as expressions of death and disease, of addiction, sex. I saw a quote in an article from William Patrick Day, author of Vampire Legends in Contemporary American Culture. He said, "The vampire myth's power is that we can use it as a metaphor and a language to talk about the problems of our world." In other words, safe to assume that this twilight time for the vampire genre may very soon slink away to its coffin, but will surely reemerge in different forms for eternity. Jarmusch echoes Day's take on the myth, saying of Only Lovers that, for our film, the vampire is a resonant metaphor, a way to frame the deeper intentions of the story. Josh, this being a Jarmusch film, there's story, but not much in the way of plot. Hiddleston's Adam is an underground musician hiding out in Detroit who craves solitude and separation from the zombies, as he calls humans. Swinton's Eve leaves her home in Tangier to be with her suicidally depressed lover, and the most action we get occurs when Eve's wild sister Ava, played by Mia Wasikowska, makes a surprise visit and disrupts whatever order Adam has established amidst the chaos of instruments and antiquated electronic devices he has amassed. But what of those deeper intentions and the vampire myth? Did anything about Only Lovers Left Alive and what it says about the problems of our world resonate with you?
You know, I didn't find a one-to-one metaphor in the manner of what you're talking about, whether it's sex or disease or something like that. Maybe someone else has found that. Maybe that's what you took out of the film. But I do think this idea of the alien perspective that they have on our world is key to what's really interesting to me about Only Lovers Left Alive. He calls them zombies, as you talk about, and that's it. So there's a little bit of a mirror being held up to us here in that these are very cultured people, vampires. Right. They lived across centuries, mingled with some of the great artists. We hear references to Schubert. There's an appearance by Marlowe, played by John Hurt.
That's right.
Christopher
He's still alive.
He's still alive, apparently. And they're responsible for some of the great art as well, is the conceit of this movie. And I came out of it seeing us, humanity, from these vampires' perspective, where they're just exhausted by us.
Right.
They're really frustrated by the fact that we haven't come as far as we should have in the centuries of civilization that they've witnessed, that if anything, we've tarnished this world that we've been given. There's references to the fact how they can't even safely drink our blood anymore because we've poisoned that. We've poisoned the earth in many ways. And they're pretty much sick of us. And it made me realize coming out of this movie, I came out on a movie high because I actually did really like it for reasons we'll get to. But I also felt a little chastised by it
sure.
in the right way because, you know, we do this. We are zombies. We'll put these blinders on and not pause to appreciate whether it's great art or there's a little scene here where they notice some mushrooms that are growing in the ground and both Adam and Eve pause to talk about how remarkable that is.
There's a certain folly there. It doesn't make any sense, and that's beautiful.
Exactly. They take the time to appreciate that and how we often don't in our busy lives of inanity. And so the movie to me was an inspiring, chastising reminder to do that, to appreciate really great art, to take the time and do that for movies like this, because I think Only Lovers Left Alive qualifies as a great movie.
Well, I don't know what kind of inane life you're leading, but
you just
I don't put
live
myself
in this stuff
into that category
all the
at all.
Time. Right?
I'm not going to take your chastisement here, Josh, but I do love this notion you brought up of the mirror. I didn't think about it in those terms, and it's a little bit ironic since vampires mythically can't look
right
into a mirror or they don't see their own reflection. But of course, it really does have to be a mirror to us because we don't see us in this movie. Yes, we do a little bit. There's an Anton Yelchin character who's kind of his go-getter. He's a guy who shows
very
up.
Funny.
He gets his music out there a little bit, maybe gets his music out there more than he would like. And we do see some people who show up uninvited. They're rock and roll kids, as
yeah.
I think he calls them, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with them. He doesn't want to have anything to do with these zombies at all. But Yelchin's really the only one we see.
Pretty
and
much, yeah.
There's one excursion to a bar where we see a few more. But otherwise, we spend all this time with these two vampire characters. And I don't know what your thoughts were about this movie. I mean, I know we were both interested in it because it's Jarmusch, and something about him doing a vampire movie seemed really intriguing. It's probably fair to say that a lot of us thought that was maybe an odd match, but not only then is the movie pretty great, I'm with you completely there, but you start thinking about the main characters in his other movies, and I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen the big ones, and you realize that he's been fascinated by this notion I brought up there of the other since he first started making movies, by people who are closed off and they're on the fringes of society, whether by their choosing or society's choosing. Certainly Ghost Dog comes to mind. He's kind of a vampire character, right? In
yeah.
his way that he wants privacy and he lives by his own code, has his own methods, just like the vampires do. But I mentioned the absence of plot. This is definitely a mood piece. And while I think this can be said of a lot of movies, I think it's particularly true of Jarmusch's work in this film in particular, that how much you ultimately like it is going to be determined simply by how much you enjoyed spending time with these characters. Because, as I said, that's really what we're doing, whether it's driving around Detroit in the car with them or just sitting in that living room or watching them talk on the phone to each other. We spend most of our time just hanging out with them, and I did really enjoy that. It helps, of course, that I can't think of anybody better to cast as these mysterious vampire figures than Swinton and Tom Hiddleston.
They're perfect.
You know, last week we did our top five performances by non-professionals, and if we didn't know them so well, if we hadn't seen these two performers in so many other movies, I could probably believe that Jarmusch somehow found them on the street, found actual vampires.
This is how they lived?
Why not?
Yeah,
right? Because
yeah.
They do just, they ooze that. They ooze this kind of ethereal cool. And of course, it's the cool that you need it to be, which is cool that comes without trying. Think of the coolest people you know. It's all because they aren't trying at all. And I think that applies to a lot of Jarmusch's characters. But again, especially these characters, that's kind of the whole point, is they have to just pull it off. And they pull it off with Swinton. It's not so much cool as it is this sage wisdom and this warmth. And her warmth balances out the aloofness and the coldness of Hiddleston. But I think in general, there's something about those two actors that's just otherworldly about them physically as performers, but what makes them great, and we see it come through here in this movie, is there's a well of emotion and vulnerability in them. And I don't think we normally think of vampires on screen as being vulnerable. They certainly are. What they can also do is pull off the humor. And I'm not saying this movie is chock full of laughs, but Jarmusch has a really deadpan style of comedy, and you need it here with this story, which you noted is not only kind of ridiculous in it being this vampire movie, but when you've got a Marlowe character come on screen, and it turns out it's really Marlowe and they're joking about Shakespeare and all that stuff, that's jokey in a way that you have to pull it off. And yeah, they do,
it is
absolutely.
Jokey. I don't understand why you don't live in the same place, because you can't live without each other. Anyway, give my regards to that suicidally romantic scoundrel.
Do you really think he is?
Scoundrel.
Well, let's hope he's just romantic. Even so, I mainly blame Shelley and Byron and some of those French arseholes he used to hang around with.
God, I wish that I'd met him before I wrote Hamlet. He would have provided the most perfect role model imaginable.
Jokey is a good word for it, actually. And it might be, as a matter of fact, too broadly jokey for some people, some of these references that they make. But you know what Swinton and Hiddleston have in common? And we've seen it before in their blockbuster appearances. They don't do these a lot, but Hiddleston is Loki in The Avengers and Swinton is the White Witch in The Chronicles of Narnia. They're able to inhabit theatricality naturally.
Yeah.
They just wear it.
Because they're not American.
You don't. That's all it is, huh?
That is what it is.
I don't know. I think I've seen some pretty bad British performances going big like this.
Mm.
And you know, you look at them, their hair looks like it hasn't been combed in 200 years, but you don't laugh at it. You just buy it. Completely buy it. So there's no hurdle there at all in playing these outsized characters. Part of this is also that they can do the other side of that. They can bring the humanity, if you can use that term, for these characters to it as well. And together, they are so perfect. That is really what makes this movie work, because you're right. We mostly spend time with them. The movie begins with them apart, interestingly,
mm-hmm.
and we see their separate routines. I'm glad it did that for a reason I'll get to. But when it does bring them together, it really hits its stride, because you immediately feel the way they look at each other, the way they finish each other's sentences, that they've spent centuries together. You have that sense. When they first reunite and they even touch each other, you get the sense that it's the way people do who are excited about re-encountering familiar flesh that really breathes off the screen mm-hmm. in those scenes. And then as they go on, you don't need much more plot after that, because you're simply interested in seeing how they live together in this world. But going back to the opening where they are apart, he's in Detroit and she's in Tangier. What I like about that is they're both rooted in old world settings,
right?
In a way, she more literally, because it's a ancient Moroccan city. He, there are references to his past in England. So you have the old world there. And even this new world setting of Detroit, what a brilliant idea to set this film mm-hmm. in Detroit, because as it currently stands with people abandoning it, it's an old world feel to it. The streets are empty that they go through. They drive right into this grand old theater at one point that's been pretty much abandoned, and just take that in. And the sense of history being dragged along slowly, a history that's really a part of their present lives,
right,
because they've been around so long. You really feel that in this film.
I do love the Detroit setting, and I love how it's used in particular, in that this is a phenomenon we've seen recently. And I've seen some articles about this over the past few weeks, how when you see certain car commercials on TV or whatever it is in pop culture that references Detroit, and actually people going to Detroit as tourists and sort of taking pictures of the degradation, it has become what some people refer to as poverty porn.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that I never felt that once watching this on screen. It doesn't mean that you don't see some of those buildings, and it doesn't feel like almost an old world city in ruins versus a more modern American city, obviously, but he's not overly reverential about it, which can come off as false, and it does in commercials, but there's no sentimentality to it either. And as I said, he doesn't revel in the degradation and despair. He takes that environment for exactly what it is, which is something that humans built, humans have destroyed, mm-hmm, and humans could rebuild at some point. And that's a theme that actually runs throughout this entire movie. You're listening to Film Spotting. The movie we're talking about is the new vampire movie, if you can call it that, from director Jim Jarmusch, Only Lovers Left Alive. And I want to talk about that notion of the vampire movie, because what I love about this film is the way Jarmusch riffs on vampire movies in a way without it ever feeling like just riffing. It's not at all about other movies. It's not about cinema. It's more about reapplying this vampire myth. For example, you've got vampires who are in danger. You know, you touched on this notion that they can't just go kill whenever they want to be satisfied and to be fed. They have to come up with ways to acquire blood that are more practical. And that's really hard, as you can imagine. And the fact that they could die, yes, we've seen enough vampire movies to know that there are ways they can die, but they're pretty hard. They're very specific, and they revel in their immortality. And that's what we regard vampires for, mainly, I think, is the fact that they can't be killed. They're going to live forever. Here, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that contaminated blood, because of what humans have done to their bodies and to their natural resources, there's a sense that, you know, you go bite into the wrong neck. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? You could end up dying. And there may be some room for metaphor exploration there as well that we don't need to necessarily go down. But this idea that they're not a threat. Vampires are always a threat on screen, but here I actually feel like they're more the threatened. And whatever powers they have, and we see some of those powers in brief glimpses, they're not having any fun with them, which in a lot of vampire movies they are. So I love the way he takes those ideas and those concepts and reapplies them here. But that whole idea of a metaphor, and whether or not Jarmusch is trying to do anything one-on-one, I don't think he is, certainly. I think it's more about using the overall vampire myth to explore deeper problems, things that are modern problems for humanity in general. But there is this idea, when you watch how he shoots the scenes where they acquire blood and the scenes where they actually consume the blood, it's hard not to see a correlation to a notion of addiction, or if not addiction, to drug use in general, right? The way they go out at
sure.
night and they're walking those back alleyways. And of course, there are some drug peddlers out there who think that's what they're trying to do. But when they do get the pure stuff, the good stuff, as they discuss it, which of course, drug users talk about it in those terms as well, they have this heroin-like experience that we're used to seeing on screen. They go into a state of revelry. It's a pure bliss when they drink it. And Jarmusch shoots those moments with this swirling camera floating around them, and they're floating from their background. And we definitely see them at one point later in the film like junkies seeking a desperate fix. So I don't think, as I said, that Jarmusch is trying to make some kind of commentary on addiction so much as there may be an analogy to this notion of these characters as being on the fringe. You think about some of the greatest artists in history. Some of these people whose portraits are on Adam's wall at one point, Tilda Swinton looks at that wall and sees all these faces of great artists, some more modern, some long dead, from music, from cinema, from literature, whatever it may be. These are people, many of them, who cut themselves off from the world because they cared about having these moments of ecstasy, whether it was through art or other substances. And I think one of the key distinctions maybe the movie draws between those types of people in those portraits and these vampires and the zombies is that the zombies are people who aren't willing to suffer for or can't really appreciate those moments of ecstasy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. They're the people who don't care at all either, even if they could create. I like the one line that we do get where Adam says what's really bothering him are these zombies and the fact that they have this fear of their own imaginations is the way mm-hmm. he describes it. So there's some level of respect here, or at least appreciation for the potential within humanity
right.
that is really lamented in this film, because again, there's this mix. We don't learn who on that wall is a vampire or who isn't. I think I saw Buster Keaton on there and
right.
got to be vampire, right?
Maybe.
I don't know. I'm going vampire with him. But I like that there's a mix, right? So the film doesn't say all of the great artists of all time were vampires.
No.
And so that goes back to this idea of the potential that even someone like Adam, who has pretty much given up, does see at least that glimmer. And Eve, she is a good counterpoint, as you mentioned, because she's more playful about humanity still. She sees them as amusing in some ways. There's that moment where she tries to encourage Marlowe to finally let the world know that he actually wrote Shakespeare's plays. And she says something about think about the wonderful chaos it would cause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so she's somewhat having a little bit of that joy with the powers or the knowledge, at least, that these vampires have in the world. And certainly we see the more traditional type vampire in the Wasikowska performance
yeah.
as Ava, the niece. And I think she's brought in probably to goose up the plot a little bit because there's nothing really happening there. But I think it worked. And one thing I liked about it is that I haven't seen that side of Wasikowska where it was really lively. I mean, she's a live wire in this
yeah.
film. And you think of her in things like Stoker or even Alison in Wonderland being
dour. She's more
dour.
Like the Hiddleston character here.
She is. Yeah, she is. And so it was fun to see her let loose a little bit there. And it's just enough. It doesn't take over the film or derail it in any way.
Yeah, I'm with you mostly, though. I couldn't help but feel like by the time her sequence was over, her part of the film was over, that it kind of felt to me, I'm going to date myself here. I never watched Bewitched when it was on TV. That was the early 70s, but it was on like Nickelodeon later
okay.
when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. I remember watching that show and I was watching this feeling like it was kind of a Bewitched episode where Samantha's mom would show up and she's a witch and she didn't really like Darren. She would just come in and just wreak havoc. That was her whole point, was just wreak havoc. And I felt like Jarmusch was channeling Bewitched here almost. And it felt a little bit flimsy to me in a way that it was sort of blatantly trying to give us an injection of some action.
You do
in this
know
movie.
Exactly where it's going.
Yeah,
I will say that. But they handle it in a light way, and
she's
it
such
also
a good
does. She's a good actress, so it works. But it also does actually turn the film in a very significant way, which we probably don't want to get into. But there's another sense of loss for Adam that's a repercussion of her actions. Let's just say that.
Yeah,
and that it really hit me how I felt he's going to have to pick up and start over in a way. And this goes back to the vulnerability, the weakness of these vampires that you're talking about, what it takes for them to carve out this little whole of an existence in contemporary society just to survive, how difficult that is, and what it means if they do lose that. I mean, you really feel bad for them by the end of this film.
You do. And as you were saying about the people on the wall and whether or not we're supposed to believe they're vampires or they were, I got the sense that they were all human beings and
okay.
they are people he reveres. And I think that is really important as you talk about there being some kind of hope amidst this chastisement, amidst this kind of condescending way about these characters and maybe about Jarmusch in general. I think if you want to extrapolate that this is probably a pretty personal film for him, I think that's a really easy way to read it anyway. The fact is, as much destruction and as many bad things humans are capable of, that wall is almost a shrine that says, yeah, but they also produce this.
Sure.
And not just that, they're still producing some great art. I like the fact that these characters weren't strictly stuck in the past. They recognize modern music. He plays
yeah.
a form of modern music, but they talk about Jack White at one point. I mean, they're still listening to things. They're still engaging with culture that is 10, 20, 30, 40 years old, not just 400 years old. They can appreciate all that. And so I do think that maybe gets at this larger point that Jarmusch may be exploring about how, you know, they can recognize the benefits of modern technology as much as he fights it, but he still does use it, but he just wants to do it on his terms. He wants to not forget the past along the way. And I think that's something the zombies are totally willing to do, and that Jarmusch is questioning here through this film, is that they're willing to just completely discard everything from the past to embrace the new. And this whole movie is a reminder of how that's not maybe a great idea.
It's a very vintage movie, right? I mean, Adam is a collector. So he has, that's one reason the Anton Yelchin character is around, is to get him classic guitars. But I think that's key, what you're talking about, the technology. Eve has an iPhone. So she connects with him through that. Meanwhile, he has to set up this contraption that brings her image on an old TV.
Right.
And I did.
But he's still FaceTiming.
He's still
FaceTiming in his own way.
But I also read that as maybe he's starting, and there's a very dramatic moment at the beginning that suggests this too. Maybe he's starting to give up. Maybe he's starting to think, this is it. I don't even want to move forward anymore. That's kind of how I read that. But your comment about this being a personal film for Jarmusch too made me think maybe that's the one-to-one metaphor, is asking movie audiences to demand more, to watch more, to be open to more. Because think about it, this is a guy who's never really made, unless I'm overlooking something, any sort of Hollywood bid, right? I mean, he's worked with bigger actors, Bill
right.
Murray, Johnny Depp, but on his
he's
terms.
He's the director on the fringe.
On his terms. He's the guy in the fringe, and this could be a call for that existence, for people to wake up and appreciate this in addition to, or maybe instead of, the Hollywood crap. There's the line right there. L.A. is called Zombie Central. So.
Right. I think there's absolutely something to that. You can look at this film on its most basic level as an excuse for Jarmusch to put up his idols, his cultural idols, and preserve them on screen. Not just preserve them, but also throw them out there, foist them on the culture that maybe a lot of the people going to see his films are already familiar with him. Maybe he's preaching to the choir, but at least he is putting them on the screen, saying, you know what, everybody out there, you're going to move on. You're going to forget these faces, but I'm not going to let you forget them as easily.
You know what's a good way to preach beyond the choir? Make a vampire movie.
Great point. Only Lovers Left Alive is out now in limited release, including right here in Chicago, open just last weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You have to leave it in your best Dracula voice.
Great.
You can also find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Massacre Theater is up next. And finally, Adam, a scene in which I'm supposed to overact. Also, I get a chance to weigh in on what Adam has called the movie of the year so far, Under the Skin. Stay with us.
Josh, I figured there had to be a fair number of listeners out there who are aspiring filmmakers or working on some kind of creative project, and a lot of those young aspiring filmmakers may have a predilection for horror movies, maybe vampires, maybe they need some clips of vampires. Where are they going to go for that? Well, of course, they can go to Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. If you go to Shutterstock.com and put in the keyword vampires, do you know how many video clips come up?
I'm going to guess 443.
So close.
Oh.
So close. 432. You're
well,
amazing.
That was close.
You're amazing. They range from descriptions and titles such as beautiful vampire woman smiling with blood on her face after bite, to roosting bats in a cave in Yasuni National Park, Ecuador, to twins running fast through eerie forest appear side by side, breathing heavily, then run off.
Yikes.
There's no vampires there, but it is a little freaky.
Sounds like a sequel to The Shining, maybe.
It could be. If you're working on the sequel to The Shining, you may need that clip. And you can find one of those 432 clips over at Shutterstock.com on their video tab. They source video clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips. They add 12,000 new video clips every week, and they offer you all the assets you need and make it easy with sophisticated search tools so you can drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and a whole lot more. And they have flexible pricing. You can just get individual clips, or if you need an entire collection of vampire clips, you can do that as well. Download them in HD or save money with standard definition or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM414 and new accounts will receive 20% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. And for 20% off new accounts, use offer code FILM414. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
It's not my fault. Master Shakespeare could do it yesterday.
Give me a speech. Do me a line.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Another little problem.
What do we do now?
The show must... You know.
Go on.
Juliet does not come on for 20 pages. It will be all right.
How will it?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and happy birthday, Mr. Shakespeare. We play that clip from 1998's Best Picture winner, Shakespeare in Love, in a nod to the 450th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, which was just celebrated earlier this week. Next week on the show, we're planning to honor Shakespeare. This is a listener suggestion, Josh, and it just worked out perfectly. We're going to honor Shakespeare with... Right now, a sacred cow discussion, or for you, it's actually a blind spotting discussion.
It is.
Of My Own Private Idaho, the Gus Van Sant film from 1991. You haven't seen it. I have, I think, only seen it once. It's now, obviously, came out in 91, 23, approaching 24 years old. Seems like it's due. It's out in a Criterion Collection edition, has been for a while. And yes, there is a Shakespeare connection there, as it's a loose adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1. So unless... listeners out there can come up with a better idea, we're going to go with that, Josh.
Now, is this also the point where we are contractually obliged to mention that Shakespeare in Love stole the Best Picture Oscar in 1998 from Saving Private Ryan? You don't really feel that way. I was pretty high on Shakespeare in Love, actually. I don't know if I'd say it was better than Saving Private Ryan, but I thought it was a really good film.
Yeah, me too.
But we're in the minority on that, right? You're supposed to get all upset about that. So we're really mad. Now we're not.
Now that we're acting, that's a great transition into Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Man, I'm just into Buddhism, and I'm at peace with the fact that me as this person probably gonna not be around. Think about a hermit crab, okay? And it's a shell, and it's like they go from one shell to the next. And that's what I am. It's like I'm just a hermit crab changing shells.
Except if you're a d*** your whole life, your next shell will be made of shit, okay? If you're an you're going to come back as a cockroach, or a worm, or a anal bead, okay? If you're a man, and you act heroic, you'll come back as an eagle. You'll come back as a dragon. You'll come back as Jude Law, okay? Which would you rather be?
Maybe the anal bead, depending on who it belongs to.
It belongs to me.
Then the dragon.
Well, that was Danny McBride as Red and Seth Rogen as Dale talking, you know, Jude Law and anal beads in Pineapple Express from 2008. It was written by Rogen and Evan Goldberg, directed a little bit oddly at that time, it seemed, by David Gordon Green.
Back on episode 485 of Film Spotting, seems like it was so long ago, I interviewed David Gordon Green about his new film Joe, starring Nicolas Cage. You can find that episode on iTunes or at filmspotting.net. Also on that episode, my interview with Jonathan Glazer, director of Under the Skin. We're going to spend a couple minutes on that in just a bit. And we shared our top five desert island directors, the five director filmographies we'd want to spend eternity with, which I think was maybe one of our better ones to pat ourselves on the back in
a
while.
You like that one, huh?
I thought that was a pretty fun show. That is episode 485, again, if you want to check it out. And that was really our only tie-in for Massacre Theater was the David Gordon Green interview. Pretty one-on-one there. David Gordon Green was on the show. We talked about Joe, and he also directed Pineapple Express. But as always, our listeners found even more connections.
This comes from Matt Peterson in Torrance, California. Besides being directed by your guest, David Gordon Green, Pineapple Express also refers to a meteorological phenomenon producing the same types of torrential downpours that Russell Crowe had to deal with in Noah. Also, Craig Robinson, who plays Matheson in Pineapple Express, recently starred in Rapture Palooza, a movie about a couple attempting to defeat the Antichrist, which is a clear connection with Lars von Trier's 2009 effort. The connections span the last three episodes.
I didn't think anybody was going to get them all. Wow. But Matt got them.
Good job, Matt.
Actually, do you believe any of that email? I think Matt made the whole thing up. Except for the Pineapple Express part, I'm not sure any of it's true.
All I know is I really want to see Rapture Palooza now.
How can you not with that name? Keegan Galea in Toronto. He also wrote in. In all honesty, I love this movie, Pineapple Express. The obvious connection being, of course, the director, David Gordon Green. Maybe a less obvious connection, however, is that David Gordon Green has done several movies in his career that would be considered Southern Gothic. And Pineapple Express co-star James Franco recently adapted William Faulkner's Southern Gothic masterpiece, As I Lay Dying, for the silver screen. Whether or not the film version is a masterpiece, I can't say, but that trailer certainly wasn't helping it.
I still want to see that one.
Yeah.
I think that was on one of my most anticipated movies of the fall list.
From two years ago or
not
something.
Not anticipated enough for me to have yet watched it.
Well, the film spotting hat, not super brimming, but definitely more than, say, The African Queen prior to that. So I'm not surprised maybe that there are some Pineapple Express fans out there amongst our listeners. Josh, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Scott Salvati from Antioch, California.
Congratulations, Scott. Our second winner in a row from California. They are just monopolizing Massacre Theater here. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
Five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it, now look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time.
That is why our producer, Sam Van Halgren, gets paid the big bucks here on Film Spotting as we transition to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. Not only a clip from Galaxy Quest that clearly has alien and space connections to this week's show, but Shakespeare in there as well.
Exactly.
Richard III. That works out so well. Alan Rickman as the frustrated actor Alexander Dane in that alien invasion comedy. And we get to this week's scene. Obviously, it's going to have some kind of space connection. And by way of a further hint, our associate producer, Candace, who is very often the one who actually pulls these scenes together and gives us the actual text, she gives our audience the first helpful clue by assigning not character names. This is the way she sent the script to us. But she identified the roles simply as first bad actor and second bad actor.
I don't know about you, but that's how Candace addresses all her emails to me. Second bad actor.
Yeah. Fair enough. I suppose I'm supposed to take some solace in being first actor.
Okay. We've really been putting poor Candace through the ringer. We had her do that Pineapple Express scene.
Yeah.
And now this one.
She had to watch this and make sure the text matched.
We got to actually do something good next time.
I agree. But is that really fair? Because they're terrible in the movie. I'm giving more clues here. Just terrible.
Yeah.
And the dialogue, as you're going to hear in a moment, is terrible.
Yeah.
But the two actors in the scene, I wouldn't call bad. They're just bad here.
There's one really, it's really shocking how bad he is.
Okay.
Let's say one of them, because you don't associate any sort of bad performance with him.
True.
I don't, at least. The other one, he's always seemed capable of something like this.
Okay. And that's going to be you. I'm going to play the guy
thanks.
Who's usually good.
I see how that worked out.
Okay, so you start this off, Josh.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Now that I know who I'm playing, let me get in the right space. Yeah, okay, I'm ready.
And action.
Give me three pans to go.
I don't know what you're so down about. You still get to be head of security, which from what I can tell is a pretty cushy job.
I can assure you that I was not groomed since birth to have some cushy job that even a moron like you could perform. While you were still learning how to spell your name, I was being trained to conquer galaxies. To do anything less is a disgrace to my entire family line.
and scene. Wow, I really love what you went for there, Josh, throwing all of our listeners off by impersonating a member of Monty Python.
Was that what it was?
Was that what you were going for? Because you nailed it.
Sure. Oh, and we were supposed to be drunk in that scene, too.
We were.
Another clue, in case you couldn't tell by our line readings.
If you know what film we just massacred, though I don't know that you can massacre that film.
Nope.
Email the title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline, Monday, May 5th. That's the 5th of May, Cinco de Mayo.
Thanks for telling me that. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Also at filmspotting.net, we will link to more information about an upcoming event that we want to promote here because it is the Chicago Critics Film Festival, Josh, the second annual Chicago Critics Film Festival. It's put on by the Chicago Film Critics Association, of which we are members, though we have absolutely nothing to do with this festival.
We can't take any credit whatsoever.
No, we can't, which is unfortunate because last year they had a great lineup, had some great guests, including Sarah Polley,
yeah.
The Stories We Tell. And I think they've got another really good lineup coming to the Music Box. This is May 9th through the 15th, and some of the notable films coming to the festival are They Came Together. This is the opening night film of the fest, directed by David Wayne, stars Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler, which you really can't go wrong there with those three. Willow Creek, the new film from Bobcat Goldthwait, and I'm a fan of his previous films, God Bless America, and before that, World's Greatest Dad. The One I Love, this is a new film starring Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, and I, Origins, the latest collaboration between Mike Cahill and Britt Marling, who Film Spotting listeners may recall, were featured in an interview here on Film Spotting for their last movie, Another Earth. So some great stuff coming, some more guests that weren't even mentioned there. Actually, David Wayne is coming to the festival, another former Film Spotting guest, and I believe Bobcat Goldthwait as well. So if you want more information about that festival, you can find it at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com.
So you live alone?
Yes.
You think I'm pretty?
Well, I know, gorgeous.
Come to me. When was the last time you touched someone? You don't want to wake up, do you?
Scarlett Johansson from the heavy on intrigue, less heavy on dialogue trailer for Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin. 2 weeks ago here on the show, we shared my interview with Glazer about the film. And at that point, Josh, you hadn't seen the movie, but you've since caught up with it. And we wanted to spend a couple minutes on it. This is a film that as more listeners have caught up with, we're seeing a few more comments come in. One of our followers on Letterboxd said, I just saw this last night and I need someone to help me deconstruct it. I really hope you discuss this at length on Film Spotting. And someone over at the Film Spotting Forum on our website wrote in and said, usually when I go see films after I've heard them reviewed on Film Spotting, I go back to the review. I can't recall if you and Josh reviewed Under the Skin or was it just an interview with Jonathan Glazer, but I saw it today and my forward review is beautifully shot, yet pointless. Adam, unless you and Josh plan on doing an actual review of this film, please briefly explain why this is one of your favorite films of the year thus far. Trust, this is not a presumptuous request to explain yourself. I value you and Josh's thoughts, even if I don't always agree. And I thought maybe I'm missing something here and would appreciate your insight. Right now, I'm just not getting why most critics are going gaga goo goo over
gaga goo goo.
That's
is that how you describe your
says.
Reaction?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just like a toddler, basically a young infant in response to this film. So I am making you do all the heavy lifting here, as we did feature my interview, and I did cover in that interview a lot of things I really did respond to positively in the film, but I've already called it the movie of the year so far. It's definitely going to come up in my top five films of the year so far. We're going to talk about this movie more. For now, though, can you help any of our listeners as you've just seen it? Can you help deconstruct it? Can you help give any insight into why?
I just have to explain.
This is a good movie.
That's all.
There you go. Just the plot.
Well, I think there are, there's one fairly obvious thing you could go to if you wanted to seek out an explanation, and it's to read this as a female empowerment story.
Sure. I mean,
the way Johansson deals with these men, lures them in, what happens to them, and there's an interesting use, I would argue, of nudity differently mm-hmm. than it's often used in films in general, but also movies that feature alien seductresses. So there's that there. I think it's an element. It wasn't the most compelling thing to me about Under the Skin. I actually found it to be a richer consideration of just this idea of body image. Mm-hmm. I mean, here you have an alien who has adopted this form for very specific utilitarian reasons. And yet it does have effects on men and how they respond. And boy, I feel in retrospect when I wrote about this on my site that I went too far in describing one of the passengers she picks up, because the movie really takes a turning point. So I don't want to get into that there. But let's just say this idea of body image expands because of what this passenger looks like.
Absolutely.
And the movie completely changes from that point on. And we start to consider things like, what we look like. How does that determine how people respond to us? How does it determine how we carry ourselves? What do we say with our bodies? Mm-hmm. There's just a ton of stuff there. But even set that aside, this isn't a movie that I feel you need to have explained to you to necessarily appreciate. There's so much aesthetically going on. It's very impressionistic. You could argue that there's really no obvious evidence that she's an alien in this film. There's some very odd images going on, but none of it is over the head explanatory.
Right.
The whole opening sequence is very impressionistic, but in a really beautiful, intriguing way. Possibly my favorite thing about the film at this point, though it's one I'm definitely going to want to revisit again, is the score.
Oh, the score's
great. The soundtrack by Micah Levi, I believe, is her name. It has these distant hums in it. There's these little squiggly strings every once in a while, and then we'll get a sudden thump here or there. And it's very atmospheric. You know, the obvious reading is that this is what is going on in the alien's head. This is kind of a little glimpse of what her actual world might be like, or her perspective is like. It certainly works on that level, but it also just lends this eeriness to the film overall, because aside from those impressionistic splashes, it's largely set in, glum suburban Scotland. But when you have that music going on, it brings the extraterrestrial eeriness down to earth in a really effective way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's a ton to dig into with this film.
There is. In fact, there's so much that, for me, the really compelling stuff in terms of diving in and getting at everything that is maybe effective and not effective. I really want to have a discussion with you about some of the things I'm still wrestling with on the movie, but you just can't do it without getting into complete spoiler territory.
Yeah.
Because it really is stuff that takes place in that last third or so of the film since the moment that you described. Though I will point out, as vague as I'm going to be here, that I saw the screening of this movie the night before my interview. Scott Tobias was sitting next to me from That Is All. He had already seen the movie. And afterward, during the Q&A with the audience, the director, Jonathan Glazer, gave a pretty straightforward, specific answer in terms of describing a key point when you see a shift in the alien's character. And it's way before, Josh, the moment we're talking about, way before it. And Scott Tobias and I looked at each other and said, we didn't see that at all. Like, we didn't read that scene at all the way the filmmaker just described to us that he sort of intended it. And in retrospect, you can think about it and go, okay, I can see how you could read it that way, but I think that's also one of the beauties of the film, is trying to pinpoint the moment when we see this character who, as you said, comes to Earth with very utilitarian purposes. She has a function, she has a job to do, and that's all she cares about. When you see that start to shift, and that's ultimately what the movie then becomes about. And there's a lot to discuss there. As I said, I know we're going to talk about it more as the year goes on. I think we may also try to get into it a little bit in some bonus content. That's where maybe we can get into spoiler territory a little bit. That's Under the Skin, again, out now in limited release.
Do you hear that theremin, Adam?
I do.
That means it's time for our list of things from space that came to destroy us. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Oh,
quick interruption for some thank yous here, as we also recognize our featured musical artist this week. That's EMA, a.k.a. Erica M. Anderson, from her sophomore album, The Future is Void. You heard When She Comes and So Blonde. She's currently on tour with dates this weekend in New York City, Philadelphia, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's coming here to Chicago, Josh, playing The Empty Bottle on May 4th.
You know what that is? The day before Cinco de Mayo.
Thank you for telling me that. We get to our donors, and we do really want to thank all of our monthly donors, whether it's $2, $5, or $10 a month. You guys, as we always say, are the lifeblood of the show, and you really do keep us doing what we're doing. We have two new donors we want to thank this week, starting with Chris, and his Sam Van Halgren nickname is Always Bet on Beige. He's in St. Louis. We also have another Silver Club donor who not only gave us a Silver Club donation, Josh, but also signed up. Her gratitude was so immense, she signed up for a $5 a month subscription. She sent us this great note, Caroline from Dallas.
Hey guys, I'm finally paying up since I've made it through the entire archive in way too short of a time. This payment is phase one of catching up for the back episodes. I absolutely love the show. It's so nice to hear in-depth, considered opinions about all sorts of films. I really enjoy the top five lists because I like to hear about older movies I may have missed. I've learned to keep pen and paper nearby while I'm listening so I can make lists of movies I need to watch. I put my film spotting discoveries in two groups. First, the films I knew about, but hearing you talk about them gave me the push I needed to watch them. These include, but are not limited to, Jules and Jim and Easy Rider. Thanks for both of those. The other group is the films I never would have known about. I saw Enough Said after hearing you talk about it, and it became the movie I recommended at the end of the year to all of my friends. The other one is one I think Adam mentioned in passing, Girl Walk All Day.
Yeah, that came up at our end of year show a couple years ago.
Yeah, not this past year, the year before, I think.
Right.
It was one of the most interesting movie experiences I've had, Caroline says, and I'm so glad I had the chance to see it. Thanks for helping me think more about why I like or dislike a film. Keep up the great work. Also, Adam, I'm so glad you're back and your family is doing better.
Thank you.
Josh, you and Michael did wonderful work in Adam's absence. Thank you. Keep bringing Michael back whenever you want, especially if he keeps saying lovely things about his girl Friday.
I think he's programmed to.
Yeah, you can count on that.
I don't think he can avoid that. So thank you so much for the kind words there, Caroline. And again, thank you to all of our new donors and to all of those who have already signed up or donated to the show. Also want to end, as we usually do, with a quick plug for Jeff Goldsmith and his Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast. I know that a lot of listeners get turned on to film spotting from listening to his interviews with screenwriters. You can find that by doing a search in iTunes for the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, or check out his Backstory magazine app, which is available for iPad. You can learn more at backstory.net.
You three criminals have been caught in a further act of seditious treason. General Zod, your only feeling was contempt for our society. Your only desire was to command. Ursa, the only feeling you showed was for your vicious general. Your only wish to rule at his side. Don, you are as without thought as you are without voice. This council has no hesitation in proclaiming you all
guilty. 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 Guilty.
You will lay down before me, Jor-El.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. Terrence Stamp Zod and his cronies, they're banished to the Phantom Zone in that scene from 1978 Superman. Zod, Ursa, and Non, all contenders for our top five this week. Though, let's be honest, if you're going to pick one of those three as a contender for our top five, it's got to be Non.
Non?
Sure. I mean, the unsung hero of that triumvirate,
no,
I think, really.
No, I'd go with Ursa. I mean, finally, you know, maybe there are earlier examples, but it was just so thrilling to see a female, like, badass villain, right? I don't know how often we got that.
No,
so, yeah.
No, good point.
Although I don't think any of them would like you calling them cronies.
Good point.
So
no,
be careful.
They would not. But that is our top five this week. Things from Space That Came to Destroy Us. And Josh, we both like to use these lists as a chance to catch up with some movies we've overlooked in the past. You are just a little more diligent about it than I am most of the time. Was that the case this week?
It was.
Okay. I mean, give me an excuse to go check out some 1950s sci-fi I'd never seen. Yeah, I'm going to try to make time for that. So three of these picks. No, actually, I did see three things. Only two made my list. One I was a little disappointed in. So maybe we'll get to that. My number five, though, is one I had not only seen, but I saw a long, long time ago. It's The War of the Worlds. I'm going to give my 1950s American sci-fi slot to the 1953 adaptation of the H.G. Wells novel, though I do like Steven Spielberg's recent remake. I first encountered this on WGN-TV's Sunday afternoon movie series when I was a kid called Family Classics, because, you know, what's better family fun than watching the Earth be destroyed by Martians? I don't know quite how that fit the programming. But since that time, there's really only been one sound that signifies an oncoming alien invasion for me. And it's that piercing laser of noise that feels like it's burrowing into your brain. The noise does seem to come from the alien spacecrafts in the film. And they're probably the slickest special effects in The War of the Worlds. They're curved wings. They're something like metallic bats. Just was really fascinated by those as a kid, and I think they still hold up pretty well. The aliens themselves, not so much. I don't know if you've seen this or remember these, but they're really not that impressive when we do finally get to see them face to face. There's something like an obese ET, but then for some reason, right in the middle, they have this disco ball where their face should be. So I don't know what the thinking was there. They don't quite work as well, but still, this is at least where things started for me in terms of alien invasion movies with The War of the Worlds. So that's where I wanted to start my list.
There must be somebody in there. Who? Where'd you think they come from?
How would I know?
Someplace. Mars is near the Earth right now. Happens every 18 or 20 years, they say. From Mars.
Sadly, I have not seen the original War of the Worlds. I've only seen the Spielberg version, and I'm not as much of a fan of it as you are. So, didn't come close to making my list here. And I think the one movie maybe we do need to acknowledge up front, did you consider one of our former sacred cows, 2001, is the monolith an object that was sent to destroy us?
Boy, well, that's kind of what we spent a lot of time
it
talking
is.
About.
Right.
I think I fell more along the lines of, that's what it ends up doing. I don't know if that was the intent.
Maybe facilitating
our
destruction.
Our own destruction. At any rate, before we get too far derailed in 2001 talk, I did not consider it.
Okay. Well, I did, but ultimately decided I couldn't get a grasp on it, so I ruled it out. Plus, it should be in our pantheon, and maybe at some
point
it will be. My number five, well, you already heard it. We played it coming into this segment. General Zod. I'm not going with Nan or Ursa, sorry. From Superman 2, of course, not Superman 1, but I love that we played that scene because that's our introduction to them, and it happens at the beginning of the first Superman. We never see them again, and you almost don't understand why this franchise, which you don't know is a franchise at the time, but why is it spending time giving us this courtroom scene and banishing these three characters who aren't going to have any role in the movie whatsoever? Well, of course, we come to see that they are major players in Superman 2, but I always loved that opening scene with them and that guilty. When I was a kid, those faces behind the black and just their big heads,
yeah,
and them saying guilty that way, that used to kind of scare me, actually. So there was some excitement there with the beginning of Superman 1, but it is in Superman 2 where, due to an accident, just a random bit of coincidence where, of course, Superman throws that nuclear missile out into space and it happens to hit the mirror, the phantom mirror.
I thought space was bigger than that.
I know, you would think so, right? But it does free them. And there's a lot I could say about Terrence Stamp's performance and why I think it's so amazingly fun. And it gets back to our discussion of Only Lovers Left Alive in the first segment, right, where you've got this British thespian who can handle the theatricality of Zod and really pull it off without it being campy. But the funniest scene, the best scene, is the one with the president, where he makes the president kneel before him. And they have this dialogue scene and whatever, and the president finally reluctantly kneels down. And it's so great. He goes, "Oh, God." As he kneels down, the president, like, he's so dismayed and shamed, he says, "Oh, God," and Stamp says, "Zod."
Yeah.
And it's just perfect, and it sums up that character and his sense of arrogance and omnipotence so well. And I read this in doing some research for this list where I was curious what Terrence Stamp looks back on this movie, how he looks back on it, whether or not he has high regard for it. And he does, because it was, for him, a return to kind of mainstream culture, returned to acting. He'd been out of it for a while. He wasn't really getting any good parts anymore. And he had actually taken this long hiatus and gone to India. And when asked about it recently in an interview, when Man of Steel was coming out, and of course, Michael Shannon reprises the role as Zod, this is what Terrence Stamp had to say about maybe the secret behind his performance. In discussing Shannon, he said, "All I can say is he needs to be very present. When I walked onto that set, I'd been in an ashram for a year, learning to separate orgasm from ejaculation. I was rechanneling the life force, and I hadn't been working. And when I walked on the set, it seemed like everyone was asleep, but I was so, so ready."
Boy, you know, and I could feel that in his performance.
That's how good of an actor he is. He channeled that life force into Zod, and that's why he's not only one of our great movie villains, but he is my number five thing from space that didn't come so much to destroy us, but to subjugate us.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I have to think Stamp at least regrets those Black LeMay outfits.
I don't know.
They don't hold up quite as well, but it is a great performance. The fun is what makes it work. You're absolutely right. All right, for my number four, it's time for me to play M. Night Shyamalan apologist yet again. Though, I always like to note my loyalty only goes so far as Lady in the Water. I know for a lot of people that's still too far.
It is too
but
far.
It, but it does. It
I'm
does
actually going to just start referring to you as my co-host, M. Night Shyamalan apologist.
No, I don't think that would go well. Signs, though, I think it's his best film. I will apologize for that, though it has plenty of fans. I think
I like
were,
Signs. I
people were still
positively
on board for this one. It's really an internal character study in a lot of ways, but it nevertheless delivers on the thrills. He was still capable of doing that. It's a genre reworking of something like The War of the Worlds. It's a perspective of an event that takes place in The War of the Worlds, but here you're not spanning the globe. It's almost claustrophobically realized because you're asking what would an alien invasion, a worldwide alien invasion, look like from the point of view of one family in one remote farmhouse. Mel Gibson gives a strong performance here as this misfit father and widower. He's a former priest, and he's closed himself and his kids off from the rest of the world on this farm. Joaquin Phoenix, I think, is pretty funny as Gibson's younger brother, this one-time minor league baseball star. Now, the aliens themselves are largely in the background.
I was
going to
say, do we see them at all until the end?
Well, no, we see them. I revisited this scene, and a lot of people complained about the aliens when this movie came out.
In the kitchen, the pantry, that whole thing?
No, it's when Joaquin Phoenix is watching a news report on television at a birthday party, a little kid's birthday party, and they're all looking out the window. It's a home movie camera wondering, what's out there? What's out there? And you just get this one glimpse. And it's pretty much, it's like a green humanoid figure. It's nothing much in terms of special effects, but what I love, and this is what is the puzzle about Shyamalan, like where this went, is how he plays that scene, because it's a parody of a lot of boo moments, but it still works as one, too. It's really funny, and that's where we first get to see these aliens. But then they do show up more directly in the climax, and this is another great thing about Signs, is it shifts genres all of a sudden, because now it becomes, in essence, a zombie film. We've got Gibson and his family holed up in this farmhouse under attack, just like the protagonists were in Night of the Living Dead. So I do have another movie coming up on my list that mixes sci-fi and horror a little bit less elegantly, but I'll save that. For now, Signs is my number four.
Okay. Like I said, I was a fan of Signs when it came out. I've still only seen it once, but in terms of feeling like a director was in complete control of his audience and just pulling all the right strings, that's what I felt about Shyamalan there. Unfortunately, I haven't felt that again with him. I don't think many moviegoers have. I realize that my list here is dominated by 80s movies. As a child of the 80s, maybe not a big surprise. And my number four is The Predator. Predator.
Who's our backup?
No such thing, old buddy. This is a one-way ticket. Once we cross that border, we're on our own.
This is getting better by the minute.
You and went Predator?
I did. I totally had to go Predator. And I actually really relish the fact that I get to talk about Predator here a little bit. And what's funny is, of course, as I was forming my list and thinking, yeah, the Predator is definitely making it, I wondered, is it possible that somebody out there has some grand take on this movie? This film that I always just thought was this dumb action movie from the 80s, albeit one I really liked. Is it somehow deeper than that?
Stick around. Knock, knock.
Is it some kind of allegory for something else? So I started Googling to see what I could come up with.
The answer is no before you started Googling.
Well, we'll see, Josh. We'll see. Because I did find this take from Jake Cole. You may be familiar with him as well. I think you may follow him on Letterboxd. That's the only place I know him from. He's a freelance critic, and he's on Letterboxd. And this is his Letterboxd review of Predator. starts as a critique of Reagan-era CIA operations, with slaughters in Latin American jungles designed to protect certain interests, interests, by the way, that have nothing to do with those doing the fighting, who must be lied to even get them to sign up. But then it moves far deeper as this political commentary is extrapolated into a moral and biological abstract. McTiernan, that's director John McTiernan, routinely redefines who is the technologically superior force and who is outgunned, who is invisible and who is a sitting duck, and who is fighting for survival and who is simply displaying primal savagery. The Predator could be the spirit of the massacred gorillas, becoming the jungle itself as it picks off imperial invaders. But it is also, of course, an invader itself, killing for the sport of it. By moving well beyond any neat thematic notion, McTiernan could easily have lost track of the film, but the editing and shot construction make clear visually what almost sounds like a head trip on paper. What starts as a potential commentary on 80s American politics slowly undermines the generic themes that celebrated that foreign policy through blockbusters.
Valiant effort.
You're bleeding, man.
I ain't got time to bleed.
You sell stuff? It's all bullshit. All of it. The cabinet minister, the whole business.
My orders were to get somebody in who could crack these bastards.
So you cooked up a story and dropped the six of us in a meat grinder. What happened to you, Dylan? You used to be somebody I could trust.
Valiant effort. And I don't think he's kidding. I don't think he's being ironic.
No, I don't think he is either. And we've acknowledged McTiernan with Die Hard has shown the ability to, spoof macho tendencies.
Yes. But Are we buying any of that?
Too much. I was dazzled by the beefcakery. I couldn't pick up on any of that.
Right.
Because of
Schwarzenegger,
what else is going on?
Jesse the Body.
Ventura, I mean,
Carl Weathers.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And surely everyone listening has seen Predator stuck in the jungle. This predator, this alien being, they have to figure out what it is hunting them down. That's the plot.
I will say that it's an awesome alien. I mean,
yes.
As a kid,
yes.
I was wowed by the alien. I have seen it recently. Terrible film, but awesome alien.
Okay,
so
I haven't seen it recently, but that's what I wanted to say. I always thought that of the movies I loved when I was 12 years old, I thought Predator is one that would actually possibly hold up, or at least hold up better than some others, because of its simplicity of its story, its simplicity of purpose, the clarity of its characters, what everyone's after. And I'm sure there are some laughable lines and some laughable line deliveries, but I think they're all of a piece. And I do like the alien. That's why Predator made this list, because of that mystery that drives the film. What is this thing? And the way you see it blending into the jungle, so you don't ever really get a bead on what it is, and the mystery of its motivations. Okay, it's clearly here to kill them, but why? We don't really understand it until, you know, a good way portion through the movie. It's also, Josh, distinct from the other aliens on my list, and probably yours, in that it really isn't here to destroy us. It's not here to destroy humanity. It doesn't have any grand designs on destruction or enslavement or using people for food or whatever. It turns out it's just here for sport. It probably travels all around the universe going to whatever places it can find, or at least all over this planet looking for different things to hunt down and kill. And it really doesn't have anything bigger than that that it's trying to accomplish. Is there any kind of commentary in the fact that this creature travels to this foreign country to find this elite American fighting force in order to have a good time, and the force itself seems to be somewhat out for the sport of it themselves? Maybe. I don't know that I'm going to go there, but the fact is John McTiernan had that run in the 80s of Predator, Die Hard, and The Hunt for Red October. Three really good action films from the 80s. At least that's how I remember them. I have not caught up with Predator in a long time.
I
still like the alien.
I know I still like the alien. I know I shouldn't say this, but I'm recommending Predators from 2010, which is
really,
which is
no,
yes, it's a better,
no
it's a
way.
Better film.
No,
Adrian Brody, directed by Nimrod Antal. I mean, come on, it is a better film though. It is a better film. All right. Now I'm going to pay for that. I know it. My number three, this is one that I was able to catch up with for the first time. I had actually never seen one of the supposed worst movies of all time. And all I can say is that it lives up to its reputation. It's Plan 9 from Outer Space. And it's not just that this is good, bad. I mean, we have plenty of those, especially in the sci-fi genre. But it's more that director Edward D. Wood Jr., he brings a confidence to this material you could just feel coming off the screen. And it can only be attributed to extreme self-delusion. So we have the epitome of camp here. I mean, mind you, this came out in 1959. So we're 6 years right after the War of the Worlds, which has not the creatures, but those spacecraft are pretty impressive effects. Yet Wood here includes countless insert shots of his flying frying pans as if they're equal to that or better or an improvement. And there's just no way that they are. It also has stabs at poetic dialogue and voiceover narration that's spoken with the utmost sincerity. One of my favorite lines is, "It was the sundown of the day, but also the sundown of the old man's heart." And that old man, by the way, is a very, very sad Bela Lugosi. Overall, this has a misplaced pride that's so pure and joyous. I think this is why Tim Burton wanted to make the movie with Johnny Depp, Ed Wood, because that's what it captures, is that love of making a movie, no matter what the movie is. You can really feel that when you're watching Plan 9 from Outer Space. Now, as for the aliens, I don't think I can do any better than describing them the way the movie does, which as grave robbers from space. For reasons that are never quite clear, these aliens are reanimating the bodies of the recently dead. So this is where the mixture of sci-fi and horror that I mentioned earlier comes in. Now, to be fair, there's sort of an eerie visual poetry to the performances by Tor Johnson and Vampyra as two of the zombies. Johnson's resurrection scene is pretty iconic. That's worth checking out alone. But the actual aliens, they look like normal people, and they're played by Dudley Manlove and Joanna Lee with this odd sort of calmness. It's like they're hosting a PBS pledge or something, not trying to take over the world. Their leader, however, who's played by the oddly theatrical John Breckenridge, and another great detail is that for some reason he sports a medieval tunic, and it even has an emblem of an axe on it, even though he's like from some futuristic planet. So I could go on and on about the awful delights of Plan 9 from Outer Space, but I'll save that for people to discover. It really is one of those terrible movies that's worth a watch.
Yeah, I need to see it still. I've only seen it as it's being shot in the Tim Burton movie, Ed Wood. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five things from space that came to destroy us, inspired by the new film starring Scarlett Johansson, Under the Skin. For my number three, I'm definitely picking the movie here versus the alien, because this is an alien we never see, and it's the deadly microorganism from The Andromeda Strain, the 1971 Robert Wise directed film from the Michael Crichton novel. And basically, it's the story of a small New Mexico town, a satellite crashes there, and all the inhabitants mysteriously die. So the government sends in this scientific team to try to figure out what's going on. And I went back and looked at my notes for this movie, Josh, because this was one of the early films in a 70s sci-fi marathon we did here on Film Spotting 4 or 5 years ago, I think. And the things that stood out for me about this movie is that the whole film really is about the science. It's showing us every single step of this process, trying to figure out what this strain is, almost as if the filmmaker was out to make a case for the embrace of science, because that is all it's really interested in, this kind of technology and coming up with these solutions. And so many of the movies that have followed, and probably even preceded it, where there are these virus movies, right? And there's a lot of action because they're trying to keep the zombies at bay or whatever they're trying to do, while the scientists are off in a room somewhere working on a cure. Here, it's all the cure. That's the whole movie, is just them being locked away.
What the hell are you doing?
Turn off the oxygen. Put them on room air.
No! The air is thick with Andromeda. Experiment with your own life, damn it.
Andromeda will spread everywhere. They'll never be rid of it.
There are now 5 minutes to self-destruct.
It's the science part, and I think that is pretty interesting. You also get into the paranoia and fear of the government stuff that inhabits so many of these types of alien invasion movies, the fact that the scientists all pretty much operate under the idea that the military probably created the strain themselves and is just trying to harness it as a weapon. Another, as I said, very common thing, not only for these movies, but especially 70s sci-fi movies. So I like The Andromeda Strain. I think for a lot of people, it's probably a pretty slow film and they kind of want a little more of that action and crackle, but I like the fact that it respects that it's really about science.
Yeah, I remember it being slow. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but yet that paranoia really does seep in despite the focus on the science and the procedure and that sort of thing. All right, my number two, how deep does my Tim Burton love go, Adam?
Wow.
Yes, deep enough that my number two is Mars Attacks. I think I may be the only person who does like this movie, but one reason...
Tim Burton doesn't even like Mars Attacks, I'm sure.
No, I think he does. I think that's one of the reasons why the performances, not all of them, but the majority of them are pretty bad and out of control, because I think he was having such a blast with the aliens. So I'm focusing on the aliens, though I like this movie overall for this pick. It is his spoof of the War of the Worlds, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and their ilk. The aliens are these computer-generated creatures who... They're little green men, but they seem to be more modeled on the gremlins more than anything else. They're mischievous. They toy with humans. There's just that great throwaway shot where their flying saucer is trying to tilt the Washington Monument after the Boy Scout troop to make sure it lands on them. There's also the scene, the classic we come in peace scene, except here a hippie unwisely lets loose a dove that doesn't last very long. Burton and his animators, they gave these aliens a really great aesthetic too, that's drawn largely from the trading cards that inspired the movie. I love the touch that the aliens are wearing these kind of glass helmets, like they're in a cheesy 1950s TV show with astronauts or something. And of course, the sound of their guns is a nice audio nod to those lasers from the War of the Worlds. So the humor is very broad here, yes, and many of the performances are pretty bad. I like Jack Nicholson's president. I'm not so wild about the real estate developer he plays in the dual role, but I just think Burton was having such a good time with those aliens that he wasn't even paying attention to what else was going on. Pays off for me.
Well, we go from your number two pick, a movie nobody likes but you, to my number two pick, a movie everybody likes but you.
Oh, no.
I've got three words. Norris Spiderhead. It is The Thing from John Carpenter's The Thing. Yes, another 80s movie. And what I like about this movie, mainly, Josh, even though I know your take on it, is you see it as just a lot of splatter and a lot of gore for the sake of gore and special effects for the sake of special effects. But I like the fact, what has always appealed to me about the film is the fact that it uses this crazy parasitic life form that seems to be able to assimilate any organism it comes into contact with. And it uses that to explore power and group dynamics. That really is what the film is about. So the enemy isn't so much the thing, which we see in a lot of monster movies. The enemy really becomes the other people in the room, the other people at this station. And of course, it does feature one of those great growly 80s Kurt Russell performances as MacReady that I really do enjoy. But for me, this was almost my number one because it's both this grotesque thing, this bizarre life form that makes your skin crawl just to see it on screen in all of its different incarnations. The effects, of course, famously by Rob Bottin, but what also makes it such an interesting character, if you will, this thing, is that it's also us. It's like an alien movie such as Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? Where the real horror comes from the fact that the other creature is really us. It's the neighbor, it's your husband, it's your wife, whatever it might be. And we see that in, as I said, the way this creature assimilates and becomes other people. So really, for me, the suspense of the thing, the real horror of it, goes beyond just the obvious gore. And it really becomes this sense as the movie goes on that, okay, what happens if this thing does get out of this station? Is it ever going to be stopped? This one little creature could, in fact, somehow assimilate all of humanity, potentially. And that was fascinating enough to me at the time I saw it, which actually wasn't until probably later in the 80s. I don't think it's a movie I saw as a kid. If I saw it when it came out, I wouldn't have been able to sleep alone for probably weeks or months. So it was later when I caught up with it. And even more recently when I've seen it, you know, the effects, yes, I've said it and gotten chastised for it here on the show for saying that the effects are a little bit dated. They are, but it doesn't ruin the experience of the film for me at all.
Yeah, I have a John Carpenter problem, and I think I need to listen to a John Carpenter marathon that someone else conducts, because I undervalue a lot of his movies. I
what
think
about
the only
Halloween?
One I really dislike Halloween.
Oh, I love Halloween.
And it's very basic stuff that often with his films. It's a staging in Halloween for a suspense film that I just can't get past. Assault on Precinct 13 is probably the one, and I haven't seen all of his, so that's why I do need that marathon, probably the one I like the best. So Carpenter, yeah, I'm often alone on him.
Okay, your number one, Josh.
My number one is a movie that I just caught up with, Attack the Block. It's from 2011, a British sci-fi comedy about an alien invasion of a South London neighborhood. This time, though, it's not the military that the aliens run up against, but a gang of wannabe teen thugs.
What is that, cuz?
That's an alien, bruv, believe it. And it landed in the wrong place, though. You get the wrong place.
I'm killing them straight.
Let's get tooled up, blood.
The social satire in this thing, it's handled just about perfectly, I think. The movie essentially poses this tongue-in-cheek question. What's scarier, hostile alien invaders or black youth? And then it riffs for the rest of the movie on the sad reality that many people are going to say the latter. Now, as for those aliens, they're pretty cool. They're described as gorilla wolves, I think, and that does seem to fit. They have spiky black fur, no eyes, but their teeth and their jaws glow in the dark. And it comes across pretty impressively considering this wasn't a hugely budgeted film. It also has some smart action scenes staged by director Joe Cornish, a lot of sly humor in it, a great hip-hop soundtrack, and even to my surprise and delight, I didn't know this going in, but a small part for a very funny Nick Frost.
Wait on that. You discovered a species hitherto unknown to science.
Believe.
Maybe there was a party at the zoo and a monkey shagged a fish?
So I'd only heard good things about this since it came out. I don't know why I never got around to it, but I was glad I did finally see it. I mean, it easily would have been one of my top 10 films of 2011 if I'd seen it then. Oh, yeah.
Well, Attack the Block is a movie I enjoy as well. It's an honorable mention for me on this list. My number one thing from space that came to destroy us, Josh, I'm just going to pick at that John Carpenter scab.
Oh, man.
I should have called this the John Carpenter Memorial List, but then I wouldn't have had any picks.
Two picks, yeah.
So I would have been in big trouble. But for me, it is the humanoid aliens from They Live.
Yeah, that's one I haven't seen either.
It's really good. It's really good. It's come up on the show once or twice before, but this is that case I was kind of talking about with The Thing, where you have the fear of this gross creature, but you also have the fear of this thing walking among us and not being able to detect it. And that's what this whole film is about, is that these aliens are living among us and nobody can see them except, as it turns out, with these special glasses that the main character played by Rowdy Roddy Piper gets his hands on. And you can't watch this movie and not recognize that it was a big influence on The World's End, one of my favorite films from last year. But these aliens, they're using the Earth basically just as a resource to deplete. They're going to leave it in ruins basically someday, as we come to learn. But with these glasses on, we see how all the media is filled with subliminal messaging to obey and conform and marry and reproduce and consume. And that is fun enough as a satire. But where the movie gets really interesting for me, Josh, is where we see the bargain the humans in the movie have struck with them. Some of the humans have struck with them. The satire gets taken to another level when you recognize that basically the wealthy people, the rich, the 1%, they're the 1% because they're willing to sacrifice the long-term health of the planet and everyone else around them for their piece of the American dream, for whatever they think they're entitled to. And like a lot of good sci-fi, the whole movie is just sort of absurd and exaggerated enough and heightened enough to feel like it both could never happen and maybe already has happened. And I like, too, that the aliens in this movie, they're not really creatures so much as when you see them, they're skeletons. They look human. They look like humans would look if you stripped away our skin and revealed what's underneath. And I don't know if Carpenter was going for this or not, but maybe that is what's underneath, is these creatures. When you strip that away, that may be part of the commentary. But I do like They Live. Part of the new cult canon, according to our friend Scott Tobias, reference here for the second time I've name-dropped Scott Tobias from The Dissolve. We'll link to his discussion of They Live in the show notes over at filmspotting.net.
Can we just pause here to acknowledge that your list has included both Jesse Ventura and Rowdy Roddy Piper?
I love wrestling. What can I say?
We're learning something new about you.
Well, I don't know where we go from there. Those are our top five things from space that came to destroy us. Any honorable mentions, Josh?
Yeah, I did think about The World's End as well from last year. Really enjoyed that. Gort, from The Day the Earth Stood Still, mentioned in our show open, had to consider Gort. Monsters vs. Aliens is a fun DreamWorks animated film.
I thought about that.
From 2009. Did you like that
one? I did. I like that movie.
Yeah.
And that villain, voiced by Rainn Wilson, who wants to destroy the planet or take over the planet, is a really good character.
Yeah, they riff on sci-fi tropes, have a lot of fun with that. Independence Day, I'm going to admit, it has its moments. I mean, it's a little scary patriotic, too.
I've never been a fan of that movie.
Really?
No.
It has enough moments for me. And we do have to give a nod, at least, to Marvin the Martian from the Looney Tunes shorts. The one movie that I did catch up with, hadn't seen before, was really excited but disappointed me, was Monsters. This is a low-budget thriller from 2010 about an alien infestation in Mexico.
Yeah, it's a movie I caught up with as well just for this list and really hoped it would make my top five. And after maybe all the hype, because there was a fair amount of it in kind of cinephile circles, which I get. After seeing the movie, I get it completely, and I actually am really curious to see what that director, Gareth Edwards, is going to do with Godzilla,
yeah.
which I never thought I would say that. But after seeing Monsters, I'm curious. That said, as a movie overall, it did fall short for me in a
major way.
Certainly
potential there, though.
Certainly
yeah.
the potential as a filmmaker is there. I still considered the creatures from that movie just because there's kind of a saving grace scene with those creatures mm-hmm. near the end of the film that I thought was really pretty great. So I did consider those creatures. I considered those dog, wolf, whatever they are from Attack the Block. And we also had a reference to Galaxy Quest earlier in the film, General Saris from that movie. I didn't consider The World's End because I was thinking about this and I couldn't really remember if they actually came here to destroy us or not. I couldn't remember what their intentions were. And I know a lot of people are going to say, Adam, Pacific Rim, you love that movie. What about them? Well, they didn't come from space.
Another dimension.
Another
Even
dimension.
I know that.
That didn't work. Come on. So the kaiju, they're off. And I also didn't consider Starship Troopers. And I know some people will probably be shouting Starship Troopers throughout this entire top five. I really like that movie, but my recollection of the film could be wrong. My recollection is they don't attack the Earth. The bugs don't attack us. We attack them.
They go
them.
After the bugs,
we
right?
We go
yeah.
to their
yeah.
planet. So, again,
I think that's right.
technicalities, but they matter here for these arbitrary
Very important
film
things.
Spotting lists. We want to know what you think. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, The Other Woman, Leslie Mann, Cameron Diaz, and Kate Upton are the wife, the mistress, and the other mistress, respectively. Brick Mansions, this is a crime thriller with RZA and the late Paul Walker. And The Quiet Ones, it's a horror film about a bunch of PhDs who try to create a poltergeist. The alternate title I see here in my notes is The Terrible Idea.
Really?
I don't know why they didn't go with that. In limited release opening here in Chicago this weekend, Child's Pose, a drama from Romania. Teenage, this is a documentary about the invention of adolescence. And Walking with the Enemy, a World War II drama with Ben Kingsley. Also out, it was supposed to open a few weeks ago, got pushed back just a couple weeks. The movie I would recommend, at least from the ones I'm really familiar with here, Alan Partridge, starring Steve Coogan, playing that famous character that he's played for a long time on TV in England. And I saw this movie on demand. I think it's still available via cable on demand if you can't get out to the theater. And I think it's very funny. Among my favorite films of the year so far, actually. I think it's that funny. I love Coogan as that Alan Partridge character. So that's out this weekend here in Chicago as well. Next week on the show, as we discussed a little bit earlier, we are planning to honor Shakespeare a bit by reviewing a movie that owes something to Shakespeare. It is My Own Private Idaho from Gus Van Sant. It's a 1991 movie, so we thought, you know what? Maybe a good idea to get back to our year-by-year countdown. Just got a great email from a listener who said, I always love those lists. We hear that from time to time when we ignore those lists, and it just seemed like the right opportunity. So a 1991 film and our favorite films from that year. But if you do have any other great ideas for what we could do to recognize Shakespeare and his relation to cinema, we are open to ideas. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week comes from EMA. There's more information at thefuturesvoid.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.